on, giving Reagan an opportunity to respond. He brought up the issue of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, where Khrushchev had placed nuclear missiles pointed at the United States mere miles from Florida. Eventually, President Kennedy got the Soviet Union to back down in exchange for quietly disarming America's own nukes in Turkey. Yet for 2 weeks, the world came closer to nuclear war than at any time previously. You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale, said the moderator. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you'd be able to perform in such circumstances? Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign, Reagan replied. I'm not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience. The actor delivered the line exactly as if he were on a sitcom. Reagan calmly took a drink of water, standing there and letting the quip ride. The audience laughed, the moderator laughed, Mondale laughed. You will see that I was smiling, Mondale later said, but I think if you come in close, you'll see some tears coming down because I knew he had gotten me there. Reagan went on to win every state with the exception of Mondale's native Minnesota, which he only carried by around 3,800 votes out of 2 million. The popular vote was 59% to 40%, almost a perfect inversion of LBJ's landslide over Goldwater 20 years prior. In 1984, relations between the Soviet Union and the United States were quite poor. Both President Ford and President Carter had successfully met with Brezhnev, Khrushchev's successor. After Carter and Brezhnev signed the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, SALT II, in 1979, Brezhnev had thanked him with a big kiss on each cheek to Carter's clear discomfort. Reagan tried his best to meet with Brezhnev as well, but it never seemed to happen. In 1982, Reagan reiterated his invitation to meet in New York City when Brezhnev would be at the United Nations. Brezhnev in turn suggested a summit instead of a meeting, possibly in Finland or Switzerland in the fall. That would never come to be, as Brezhnev suffered a fatal heart attack on November 10, 1982. Nor could Reagan meet with Brezhnev's successor, Yuri Andropov, nor his successor, Konstantin Chernenko, because, as Reagan pointed out, they kept dying on me. Though Thatcher had the well-deserved reputation for being the more strident of the two, Reagan was a touch more hostile toward his rival superpower than she was. Reagan's critics, steeped in the consensus politics of détente, viewed any antagonism toward the Soviet Union as a provocative step closer toward the apocalyptic scenario of a nuclear war. In 1983, Reagan had spoken before an audience of evangelicals and denounced the popular impression that both sides were somewhat to blame for the increase in nuclear arsenals. I urge you to beware the temptation of pride, the temptation of blithely declaring yourselves above it all and label both sides equally at fault, to ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil. Yes, let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God. But until they do, let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world. To refer to the Soviet Union both as an evil empire and the focus of evil in the modern world was not the language of diplomacy. To put it mildly, Reagan's antagonistic approach did much to harden Kremlin attitudes against any sort of summit, which would be seen as rewarding his aggression. Nor was this entirely Reagan's preferred style. His forte was humor. Eyebrows were raised at the Kremlin when audio of Reagan messing around during a soundcheck leaked to the press. My fellow Americans, he had said, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. It fed into very sincere Russian fears, backed up by the fears of American experts, that Reagan was edging the world closer and closer to nuclear conflict. Reagan enjoyed recounting humorous stories that undermined conventional narratives and put his point across without being entirely explicit. This was exactly how the Russians had used their anecdote to thumb their nose at the rulers under the guise of not being serious, and Reagan enjoyed repeating some of these to American audiences. The commissar in the Soviet Union who went out to one of those state collective farms grabbed the first worker he came to. He said, how are the crops? Oh, he said, the crops never had been better, just wonderful. He said, how about potatoes? Oh, he said, comrade commissar, if we could put the potatoes in one pile, they would reach the foot of God. And the commissar said, this is the Soviet Union. There is no God here. He said, that's all right, there are no potatoes. It was a tactful way for the President of the United States to publicly declare that the Soviet Union was a godless country that couldn't feed her own people. With American and Soviet relations at an impasse, Thatcher saw an opportunity. Many Hungarians had remained skeptical, if not hostile, toward the Soviet Union after their failed 1956 revolution. By the 1980s, the Hungarian government had begun experimenting with economic liberalism while still claiming ideological fealty to the USSR. Thatcher thus chose the Hungarian capital, Budapest, as her first trip to the far side of the Iron Curtain in early 1984. She wanted to both encourage Hungary in its attempts toward freedom while also possibly encouraging a further divide between Hungary and the Soviet Union. Andropov died a few days after Thatcher returned to the UK. She realized that flying to Moscow for the funeral would be a good strategic move because it would give me the opportunity to meet the man who, to our surprise, emerged as a new Soviet leader, Mr. Konstantin Chernenko. She took the opportunity of this personal contact to invite some of the USSR's leaders to visit her in Great Britain. It was in December 1984 that a group of Soviet officials came calling, including one Mikhail Gorbachev. Rumors had already begun to swirl that he was next in line to be the head of the Soviet Union despite, or because of, his explicitly reformist perspective. On the morning of December 16, 1984, Gorbachev drove down to meet Thatcher for lunch at Chequers, a country estate set aside for the Prime Minister's use. He barely had a chance to pick up his fork before Thatcher started lecturing him. She lectured him about how central planning doesn't work and how markets do. She lectured him about the Soviets funding the British unions in the midst of another national strike. She lectured him about the USSR refusing to let Jewish citizens emigrate to escape anti-Semitism while letting others leave the country if that was their desire. Then she lectured him for not having touched his food. Gorbachev chose his words carefully and replied with the Russian equivalent of dry British wit. "I know you are a person of staunch beliefs," he told her. "Someone who adheres to certain principles and values. This commands respect, but please consider that next to you is a person of your own ilk, and I can assure you that I'm not under instructions from the Politburo to persuade you to join the Communist Party." She burst into a hearty laugh, and both then put their notes aside and had a sincere heart-to-heart. Thus it was Thatcher and not Reagan who first took notice of Gorbachev. "I like Mr. Gorbachev," she famously told the BBC shortly after the visit. "We can do business together." Her foreign policy advisor later quipped that Mrs. Thatcher came close to claiming that she discovered, even invented, Gorbachev. A politician can hardly be expected not to boast or even inflate their accomplishments, real or otherwise, but investing in a personal relationship with Gorbachev ended up paying extraordinary dividends for Thatcher. It would reach a point that members of the British Foreign Office pointed out that the PM seems to go uncharacteristically weak at the knees when she talks to the personable Mr. Gorbachev. 2 days after his meeting at Chequers, Gorbachev further broke barriers by delivering a speech to Parliament. Like any politician, Gorbachev had his own agenda with regards to the Thatcher relationship. "I knew that to some degree I was being used as a stalking horse for President Reagan," she freely admitted. "I was also aware that I was dealing with a wily opponent who would ruthlessly exploit any divisions between me and the Americans." 1 week later, Thatcher visited Reagan at the president's retreat, Camp David. She made it a point to tell Reagan what she thought Gorbachev was up to, and a point to proclaim to him how loyal she had been and remained to the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. As the declassified memorandum of their conversation put it, Mrs. Thatcher underlined that she had told Gorbachev there is no point in trying to divide Britain from the United States. This ploy will never succeed. Britain is part of the Western Alliance of Free Nations, and the Soviets should drop any illusions about severing Europe or Great Britain from the United States. She also told Gorbachev that she and the president have known each other since before they assumed their current positions, and dividing Europe from America is simply not on. However, there was one big issue that Gorbachev wanted Thatcher to communicate to Reagan that she was more than happy to share. "Tell your friend President Reagan not to go ahead with space weapons." Specifically, Gorbachev wanted her to try and figure out a way to assist him in stopping Reagan from developing Star Wars. Chapter 13, The Last Stand on Earth. Mikhail Gorbachev was born in the Russian village of Privolnia in 1931. Within a couple of years, three of his father's siblings would succumb to the famine, which killed somewhere between a third to a half of the village. The following year, his paternal grandfather would be arrested for not meeting the government's sowing plan, regardless of the fact that he had never been supplied with the necessary seeds to sow. His maternal grandfather was likewise caught in Stalin's Great Terror, arrested in 1937 for allegedly being part of a Trotskyist organization. As with many other Soviet children, young Gorbachev thereupon became an instant pariah due to being related to a class enemy. His home became viewed, in his words, as a plague house. "Even the neighbor's kids refused to have anything to do with me," he recalled. Gorbachev thus witnessed firsthand what Stalinism meant in practice. After his maternal grandfather was eventually released, Gorbachev learned exactly what his captors had done to him. Trying to get him to confess, the investigator blinded him with a glaring lamp, beat him unmercifully, broke his arms by squeezing them in the door. When these standard tortures proved futile, they invented a new one. They put a wet sheepskin coat on him and sat him on a hot stove. Yet his grandfather, like so many other loyal communists, kept the faith until the very end. He was convinced that Stalin did not know about the misdeeds of the NKVD, and he never blamed the Soviet regime for his misfortunes, Gorbachev wrote, though misfortunes is quite the odd word for him to use here. Despite all this, Gorbachev grew up as a firm believer in the Soviet system, and through diligence and hard work, rose swiftly through the ranks of the party after graduating from university. Due to his work, he thus became one of the few Russian citizens permitted to go abroad. It was when Gorbachev visited Prague in 1969 that he first understood how the Soviet Union was seen by citizens in other communist countries. It had only been a year since the Russians had sent in the tanks to put down the Prague Spring, and when Gorbachev visited a factory, the workers literally turned their backs to him in a blatant show of contempt. The USSR's power was not viewed, as the Soviet papers claimed, as fraternal help. 7 weeks after Reagan's second inaugural, on March 11, 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was appointed as the new General Secretary, the first Soviet leader to be born after the Russian Revolution. In yet another historic first, the Western European leader who had formed the closest bond with him was also the most pro-capitalist one, namely Margaret Thatcher. A relatively youthful 54 years old, Gorbachev was strongly interested in furthering the cause of international peace. As Gorbachev saw it, one of the primary obstacles preventing peace was Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative program. Both Reagan and Gorbachev viewed a nuclear exchange between the two rival superpowers as effectively bringing about the end of the world. To paraphrase the first female congresswoman, Jeanette Rankin, "You can no more win a nuclear war than you can win an earthquake." Even before he assumed office as president, Reagan took part in a discussion about what would happen if the Soviet Union struck first. One participant in the meeting argued that, should missiles be fired, that the United States should just launch a response before we were hit. "That would be the wrong thing to do," Reagan said. His advisors left the meeting almost certain that he would not retaliate in the event of an attack. Gorbachev did Reagan one better. After he assumed leadership of the USSR, Gorbachev was walked through a simulated nuclear strike so that he would know what to do should the unimaginable ever happen. As he sat there being told that missiles were flying toward the Soviet Union, Gorbachev refused to take part in a retaliatory strike. "I will not press the button even for training purposes," he said. The two men with the most powerful nuclear arsenals in the world were thus committed to never using them, though neither could be sure that the other felt the same. Both men understood that they would not be in office forever. Could the threat of nuclear war be something that could be permanently removed from mankind's consciousness? Thatcher later made the case for this sort of approach. "The history of warfare, viewed from a technical perspective, is that of an unrelenting competition between offensive and defensive weapons and strategies, with progress in the development of one being countered by corresponding improvements in the other. Thus, swords were countered by armor, gunpowder generated new techniques of fortification, tanks were opposed by anti-tank weapons, and the bomber, known at the time as the ultimate weapon, led to the development of radar systems capable of tracking its flight and the use of anti-aircraft guns and fighter planes to shoot it down. It was, therefore, written into the essential nature of warfare that exclusive reliance on that other ultimate weapon, the nuclear deterrent, could not last indefinitely. At some point, the technology of defensive weapons would catch up." This was the thinking behind the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. The concept was to figure out a way to stop nuclear missiles from hitting their target after they had been fired. How this was to be done was an enormously difficult question, for effectively, it would be akin to shooting a bullet with another bullet after the trigger had been pulled. One of the hypothesized solutions would be defensive missiles fired from satellites, which earned the program the nickname Star Wars. Critics thought the program unworkable and decided the entire project to be an enormous waste of money. As Thatcher herself told Reagan at their Camp David meeting, "Even if an SDI system proved 95% successful, a significant success rate, over 60 million people would still die from those weapons that got through." But what if it did work? In that event, with the Soviet Union's missiles rendered powerless, the United States would have a de facto nuclear monopoly against the USSR, just as it had in the brief window after World War II before Stalin got the bomb. For Gorbachev, this was of course completely unacceptable, as he made plain both publicly and to Thatcher directly. Reagan understood the Soviets' concern and came up with what he perceived to be the perfect compromise. Privately, he wrote, I had made a decision. I was going to share SDI technology with the Soviets. This, I thought, should convince them it would never be a threat to them. Buoyed by Thatcher's budding personal relationship with Gorbachev, Reagan had Vice President Bush and Secretary of State Shultz pass him a handwritten letter when they went to Moscow to attend Chernenko's funeral. Warm correspondence between Reagan and Gorbachev ensued until a meeting was set for the two men in November 1985 in Geneva. To help Reagan prepare, that September, Thatcher sent the president a letter offering her advice. Despite receiving plenty of input from his own people. I think you would expect me to give my own views, nevertheless, she began. 5 pages later, she caught herself. I certainly don't want you to feel that I'm lecturing, perished the thought. First and foremost, she recommended, was making plain to Gorbachev that we in the West are not in the business of undermining the Soviet state. She also reminded him that the West's greatest single asset was your sincerity and seriousness of purpose. Reagan took Thatcher's advice to heart, and when he met the Soviet leader, he tried his best, like any good negotiator, to establish common interests and focus on areas of agreement. Journalist Luke Cannon captured exactly what that meant to Reagan. In Hollywood, Reagan became an avid science fiction fan, absorbed with a favorite theme of the genre, the invasion from outer space that prompts Earthlings to put aside nationalistic quarrels and band together against an alien invader. Reagan liked this idea so much that he tried it out on Gorbachev in their first meeting at Geneva in 1985, saying that he was certain the United States and the Soviet Union would cooperate if Earth was threatened by an invasion from outer space. Reagan's idea was not part of the script, and it startled his advisors. It may also have startled Gorbachev, who did not have at his fingertips the Marxist-Leninist position on the propriety of cooperating with the imperialists against an interplanetary invasion. In any event, Gorbachev changed the subject. Reagan thought this meant he had scored a point, and he proudly repeated what he had said to Gorbachev to a group of Maryland high school students after he returned to the United States. He also repeated it to his advisors, to mixed reactions. After that, Colin Powell, then the Deputy National Security Advisor, struggled diligently to keep interplanetary references out of Reagan's speeches. When the subject came up, Powell would roll his eyes and say to his staff, "Here come the little green men again." Yet it was clear that Reagan came to agree with Thatcher in regarding Gorbachev as a man that Reagan could do business with. As Shultz observed after Geneva, the big story was that they had hit it off as human beings. The main sticking point between the two was SDI, but their groundwork was clear. A nuclear war was unwinnable and unthinkable, and the two nations would have to do whatever was in their power to make sure that would never happen. The two agreed to meet again in hopes of reaching further substantive discussions. Several weeks later, Gorbachev offered Reagan a proposal, the complete abolition of nuclear weapons by the turn of the century. The only catch was that Reagan would have to give up on SDI. To apply further pressure, Gorbachev made his offer publicly. Reagan and his advisors had two different reactions. The president wanted to take the Soviet offer at face value and to even go one further. Why wait until the end of the century for a world without nuclear weapons? Reagan asked his team. Thatcher represented the opposing view. Privately, she found Reagan's perspective both delusional and naive and had no problem quietly making that clear. It was one of the few times, you know, when I think his aspirations left the reality of human nature, she said. The fundamental truth here is that the nuclear weapon cannot be disinvented. A world without nuclear weapons is thus quite simply a fantasy world. And despite her warm feelings toward Gorbachev, she still understood how politics worked. It is inconceivable that the Soviets would turn over their last nuclear weapon. They would cheat. I would cheat. As the clock ticked toward the next US-USSR meeting, two events made clear how omnipresent the threat of war was and just how dangerous nuclear arsenals could be. On April 5th, 1986, a bomb went off in a West Berlin nightclub popular with US troops, killing two Americans and injuring dozens of others. Reagan placed the blame on Libya and its dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, with whom tensions had been increasing for several years. The president decided to order strikes against the North African nation. For various reasons, the governments of France, Spain, and Italy all refused to allow the United States to use their bases or airspace. When Reagan then asked Thatcher to use British air bases, she was more than happy to oblige. It had the effect of cementing the Anglo-American alliance. There's another point. What's the good of having bases if when you want to use them, you're not allowed to by the home country? It made America realize that Britain was her real and true friend when they were hard up against it and wanted something, and that no one else in Europe was. They're a weak lot, some of them in Europe, you know. Weak. Feeble. Less than 2 weeks later, the Soviet Union experienced the worst nuclear accident that the world had ever seen. On April 26, 1986, Lenin Nuclear Power Station Reactor No. 4 in Chernobyl, Ukraine, experienced a meltdown. Firefighters failed to put out the blaze, so then helicopters were brought in to dump sand and other materials in order to try and smother the flames. No one from the nearby area was evacuated for over a day as radiation spewed unabated into the atmosphere. Deputy Prime Minister Boris Sherbina arrived within 18 hours of the incident and assisted in keeping matters quiet. "Panic is worse than radiation," he claimed. Shortly thereafter, the radiation was detected in Sweden, prompting questions from the Swedish government. Not wanting to accept responsibility and make the USSR look bad, Soviet authorities at first denied there was an issue. They were forced to admit that an accident had occurred when Sweden threatened to file a safety report with the International Atomic Energy Agency. It became clear that this was no minor incident, as citizens began to become violently ill and tens of thousands of people finally began to be evacuated. Now, the concern was that the molten core would melt down into the earth and contaminate the groundwater with radiation, killing an enormous number of people. Eventually, the solution of a sarcophagus to seal the problem was developed and implemented. Many men volunteered to assist, knowing it would cost them their lives. It took months for the disaster to be contained at an enormous financial and political cost. For Gorbachev, this was proof positive of two things: the dangers of nuclear power and the backwardness of having a nation run by a faceless, unaccountable bureaucracy. He publicly denounced the Soviet system that caused so much damage that July. "For 30 years, you scientists, specialists, and ministers